2001 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium, Session 275, Mormon Women in Religious Studies. Panelists, Dave Daughtry, Mary Ellen Robertson, Janet K. Reese, Maxine Hanks, Sherry Woodworth, and Janet Kincaid.
This session is Mormon Women in Religious Studies. More women are pursuing advanced degrees in religious studies than ever before, and a number of Mormon women seem to be following suit. This panel is composed of Mormon women who are doing work in religious studies and or Mormon studies. They will describe how they became interested in studying religion, what their areas of specialty are, what work they have done in these areas, and how their work contributes to and enriches the field of Mormon studies. My name is Doe Daughtry. I'm a graduate student in the master's program at ASU in the Department of Religious Studies. I'm going to go first, and I'm going to tell you a little bit about my interests and my work. Second, Janet Kincaid. She has an MA from in Religion and Society from the Graduate Theological Union at Berkeley. Third is Mary Ellen Robertson. She has an MA in Women's Studies and Religion from Claremont Graduate School in California. Fourth is Janet K. Reese. She has a PhD in American Religious History from Columbia University, and I'm really proud to say that I was in her ward. We were in a ward together in Princeton University when she was a student there at Princeton Theological Seminary. Fifth is Maxine Hanks. She's a feminist theorist, writer, teaching assistant in women's studies at the University of Utah. She's an editor and co-author of Women in Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. And finally, sixth, is Sherry Woodworth, PhD candidate from Yale University. She's also a Russian specialist and has a lot to add. So I'll just start out by talking a little bit about how I came to the field of religious studies. I'd originally wanted to study anthropology, and I did, actually, for 2 years, studied anthropology at ASU. I was interested specifically in medical anthropology because I was interested in the relationship between healing and spirituality, or healing and religion, and the psychology of spirituality and healing. I took 15 hours in medical anthropology and was never able, over the period of 2 years, to get accepted into the program. And when I went to find out the last time why it was I had been denied, it's a long story that I won't go into, but it was very interesting because this gentleman that was the acting head of our program at the time, and they ended up subsuming the medical anthropology program into the social cultural program, and so they were basically getting rid of it, and so they were paring down the number of students they were accepting. They accepted 2 students, and I was number 3 on the list. But when I went to find out why it was, or what the status of my application was, because they kept dragging it on and saying, we don't know what we're going to do, we don't know what... The response I got is to, you know, I have a 4.0, I'm well-respected, I've done good scholarship, so on and so forth. The response I got as to why I had not been accepted into the program this time was, you, and this is a quote from this professor who I actually respect a great deal. He's very inept, but he's really brilliant, and that's probably the problem. He said, if you're going to get a master's degree anywhere, from any university, you have to have more to show for the last 20 years of your life than popping out a few kids. And so that was the realization of my deepest, darkest fear that I had harbored ever since I joined the church, which was, if I choose to do this, and if I really believe that the gospel of Jesus Christ is true, that the church is true, that decision is going to mean that I will probably never be able to do or be anyone, if you know what I mean by that. I'll never do or be anyone in my life. And so that was like the realization of that terrible, deepest, darkest fear that I'd been carrying with me all those years. And it took me a year to recover, but fortunately I met to recover my enthusiasm and my belief that I really could do and be something and somebody. I had taken a course with a woman who was getting her master's in religious studies, and she kept saying, you don't belong over here. These people are going to eat you alive. You need to come over. We're all anthropologists anyway and historians. You need to come see us. And every 6 months or so, she would call me and say, oh, you know, she became the advisor to the Department of Religious Studies and got her master's degree. She said, you need to come over to us because I've talked with them and they really want you over here. And so I had the incredible experience of being recruited after being told that I wasn't going to be or do anything. I was actively recruited into the program, and it was really wonderful to find a home there and to find faculty that genuinely respected each other. But what my interests are, what I say to when people ask me why I went into religious studies, I say it's because I want to explore how it is that people all over the world answer those three questions, those golden questions, who am I, where did I come from, and where am I going? And everybody has a different way of answering that question. But really, what I don't tell people is that I'm a wounded healer, and I'm trying to reconcile who I am, where I came from, and where I'm going. And so it's an act of reconciliation for me, an exploration, and trying to figure out my answers to those questions. My own area of specialty at ASU, we have the program is set up to where there are different emphases, and my emphasis is on power and authority and hegemony, issues of violence, religious violence, and gender. And I chose that. Surprise, surprise. So that is the emphasis that I have chosen. My specific interests are, and some of them relate to the church and some don't, but of course they're all filtered through my Mormon paradigm. And no matter what, whether it's, we had Dr. Honegraaff come from a Dutch university. He's the foremost expert on New Age religion, and everything I hear from Buddhism to Hindu, everything I hear, I filter through that Mormon paradigm, and it means something to me on a Mormon level, but sometimes it's not about being LDS. But I'm interested in women's bodies and how I'd like to trace the use of women's bodies, particularly through polygamy. Starting with polygamy up to now, how women's bodies are used as a metaphor to express the body politic, and how women's bodies have been and are still used to express allegiance to the community and the covenants that we make. Back then, it was the call to polygamy, embrace plural marriage. Now, in my day, it was when I went to the temple to get my first temple recommend, being told that the prophet says not to use birth control. So the prohibition against birth control and the call to have as many children as I could have. And then today, it takes a different form. And probably if I were to ask each one of you that are younger than I am, you'd be able to tell me what that is. But I'd like to explore that a little bit more. I just finished a project it's very involved, but about Abraham, the story of Abraham, and how it is used, has been used to, our conceptualization of the story of Abraham and how it can create an environment in which women and usually female children are assigned the sacrificial, suffering, atoning role in the LDS culture, and then become victims, more likely to become victims of domestic violence and child sexual abuse. And so I just am still working on that for publication, and that was a big project. It was a real cathartic kind of project. My next project is going to be for an icons class next semester, and I think what I would like to do on that is to, because I'm interested in alternate forms of spirituality, and I'm interested particularly in how Mormon women who have become pagan or become Buddhist, this is an offshoot of that interest. What I'd like to do is interview a series of women who are self-identify as Wiccans and who have home altars. And I would like to know, if they believe what their belief in a goddess is. Do they believe in the goddess as a metaphor for something else, or do they believe in a real goddess as we believe in a real mother in heaven? And what does that look like for them? And if the icons, the objects on their altar, if they what their belief is around the efficacy of those items, those icons. And so that's my next going to be my next project. My fears have been not knowing what the right questions are to ask, because I really feel like it's important to know what the right questions are. I mean, not right, but I mean, I frequently ask my colleagues, what are good questions to ask about this topic? Because particularly in Mormon studies, I think it's time we shifted from what do Mormons believe, which is what most of the literature is about, you know, out there. We switched from that to what are particularly women's lived experiences of what Mormons believe. And that's why it's so important, this work on sexuality and the stuff that's gone on here this weekend is so important, because it gets down to the level of what our really true lived experience is of how the gospel has affected us, how it either works in our lives or works against us. I'm always concerned about destroying my children's faith, because I have at least one child who has a strong testimony of the church. And so I am constantly having to mediate my need to be honest and my need to live a congruent life and keep my integrity intact, and being really careful not to intrude on the other people in my family, particularly my children, who, after all, I'm the one that indoctrinated them to this faith. I'm the one that taught them all this stuff that now I may either disbelieve or I have differing beliefs about. I'm afraid of alienating and losing my husband. That's a real risk. I'm afraid of being wrong, of co-opting and of projecting my own, co-opting other people's faith or lack of, and I'm afraid of projecting my feelings and my experience onto that of other women. I'm afraid that, I'm concerned with, and I have fear around finding a balance between my objectivity and my own self-revelation and self, you know, how much do I reveal of myself and my experience. So that's pretty much been what I've been working on and what my concerns are. I really feel like what we're doing is important to religious studies. I'm afraid that I won't be able to find a job in Mormon studies. I mean, I don't know that my department is really excited about my work, and they want that to be my focus. I'm afraid for that to be my focus. So that's pretty much it for me. I'm going to turn the time now over to to Janet Kincaid, and let her tell you about her work.
Actually, when I grow up, I want to be as cute as Mary Ellen. You know, I almost went to Arizona State, and then I decided to go to the GTU. My name is Janet Kincaid. I have a master's degree in religion and society from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley. The GTU is a consortium of 9 Catholic and Protestant seminaries and a variety of study centers, and I chose to affiliate with the Episcopal Seminary, so I've had experience with middle-high church. And have enjoyed every moment of it. And part of that just falls in with my interest in religion in general. The way I came to be in this field was started out with this large interest in the need that religion fills in the lives of others and the need that it fills in my own life. And I was very fortunate as an undergrad to have a mentor in college who saw how talented I was as a writer and as a researcher and encouraged that and developed that in me and encouraged me to go on and do this in graduate school. My undergrad degree is actually in foreign languages and literature in German. So this was a complete departure. And before that, I was a pre-med student, so I never ended up being a doctor. But as I was saying, I became interested in religious studies because I'm fascinated by the need that religion fills in other people's lives. And I wanted to see how religion manifests itself on the social landscape. I also wanted to build bridges of understanding between our faith and other people's faiths. I believe that we all are saying the same thing. It's just that we say it in different ways, and as a result of that, we talk past each other. So, for example, the Catholics say they believe in the Holy Trinity. We say we believe in God the Father, His Son, Jesus Christ, and the Holy Ghost. And rather than taking that and appreciating it and saying, wow, we believe in the same thing, i.e. something bigger than ourselves, we take it and say, well, you don't believe in the God I believe in, and we end up with discord. So what I also wanted to do was make Mormonism more acceptable, more accessible. And doing that required a shift in language. So rather than describing Mormonism in terms of we believe, I began describing Mormonism to others in terms of Mormons believe. And this creates a dialogue rather than what can often feel like being proselyted to. So that was the other reason that I got into this field as well. My area of specialization as a graduate student was Mormon sociology and cultural studies. As an undergrad in my senior year, my specialization was sociology of Mormonism with a subspecialty in Islamic studies, and particularly Muslims in America. I was fascinated by why Americans or Westerners would become Muslims. But my primary focus was on Mormonism, again, making it more accessible and building bridges between faiths. And that's what I continued to do in graduate school. I wrote my graduate thesis on the effects of temple participation in the lives of young adult Mormons, which I will be presenting tomorrow morning. And chose that because it was what I had written my senior paper on, or I'd written something similar in my senior paper, and my graduate advisor said, do what you know. So that's what we went with. If I'd been doing a PhD, I probably would have written about reassimilating returned missionaries into post-mission life. And maybe one day if I do a PhD, I don't even know if I do that now, but it's certainly something to consider. In terms of the work I've done, of course, there's my thesis, which has been well received. I've been actually quite stunned by how well it's been received and how open people have been and how enthusiastic they've been about it. I wrote it with an enormous amount of fear and trepidation. Mary Ellen, I tell this story quite often, Mary Ellen Robertson was at my house the week that I had my defense, and the night before my defense I was sweating blood trying to figure out what to title the damn thing. I didn't want to put the word temple in it anywhere. She's like, you have to put it in there, otherwise nobody will pick it up. And I'm like, yeah. So there's my thesis that I've done. Presently, in my post-master's life, I've just been enjoying life. I've been reading again for fun. But actually, what I'm finding is in the last 9 months or so, I've become increasingly more involved in discussions around women's sexuality and women's stories about either their coming out stories or their experiences within the church and with their sexuality. So I'm not quite sure if that's a sign of where my life is going or if it just happens to be coincidence and somehow I got roped into this by default. I don't know. Or maybe it's the tie. The other thing that I've done is a little bit of consulting work, where I've been working with a local RLDS congregation in Berkeley that's struggling to grow and struggling to define their mission. And I fell into that because my advisor as a grad student was a member of the RLDS church, and he invited me to come and visit their congregation. And I've since been back on a number of occasions to speak and to do a presentation on the church symbolism and meaning and how to develop a mission statement out of certain symbols that exist in the church or certain symbols that exist in society that the church appropriates and how to have those have a greater meaning and be inclusive for everyone. So that's what I've done at this point. In terms of the contributions that my work has made to the body of Mormon studies, was that how that question went? How does my work contribute? The work that I've done in terms of my thesis contributes obviously to a growing body of work on Mormonism, although I think it could be much larger, but it contributes to that growing body, continues to open up those doors of understanding and accessibility for others. It also opens the door of understanding, both in the church and out of the church. The majority of the feedback that I get from women and men who read my thesis is, this is exactly how I feel and I wish we could talk about this. So it breaks down that barrier and gets the ball rolling toward having them talking about their experiences in the temple or, as the case is now, about their sexuality or about their lives, telling their stories. It also contributes in the sense that it's a qualitative study, and there aren't a lot of qualitative studies out there. And So it's unique in that sense. A lot of sociological work ends up being very quantitative, very heavily statistical, and is about means. And I never took a stats class, so I kind of lucked out that way. But my work lets people tell their stories, and I believe in people telling their stories. I'm a huge believer in that, and I love hearing people's stories. So I'm very proud of my work from that standpoint, and I think it makes a contribution in that way. One of the things that we talked about in putting together this panel was some of the risks that some of us have taken in pursuing religious studies, and especially as women. I don't think there's a person on this panel who, you know, if they've done something that was related to Mormon studies, haven't done it with a little bit of anxiety, and haven't sat and thought, is this going to get me into trouble? And is there a way I can write this paragraph and not have it draw attention and you know, end up in trouble? And that was certainly the case for me. I've told this story before this weekend, and I'll tell it again, and that is that on the day of my thesis defense, rather than that being a moment of joy and celebration, for me it was a moment of enormous relief. I literally sat in the office where we were holding the defense, and after my thesis advisor signed my thesis and pushed it aside, he said, "We want you to know that we understand." I still get verklempt about this, and it's been over a year. He said, "We want you to understand what a risk, we know what a risk this was for you to write this." And I just started to bawl. So it was emotionally trying. It took me 4.5 years to write. It should have only taken 2. Some of that, of course, is just transcribing interviews takes a lot of time, and analyzing them takes some time, but it certainly shouldn't have taken 4.5 years. And so I lived with that fear. Now, the irony is that about 9 months ago, I was in Houston presenting my thesis at a conference for sociologists of religion, and sitting on the front row were 3 people from the church office building, and I thought, great, I've been caught. But as it turns out, they were interested in my material because they were doing a similar study. So there is actually a copy of my work at the church office building. I think I'm safe. But there is that very real fear that I think many of us have, is, you know, what do we say? How many risks do we want to take? But I think ultimately in the end we choose the risks because they're worth it. And it's about integrity. You'll hear that word a lot among religious studies people. Integrity is very important to them. It's very important for them, too, I think, to reconcile their faith against their larger social experience and grapple with those questions in analytical, critical ways, standing outside themselves and looking in, standing outside their institutions and looking in. And I think we just finally decide, or at least I finally decided, that the risks were worth it. And I have no regrets. I'm very glad that I've done what I've done, and I'm very glad to be on such an illustrious panel of women. These are all women that I respect and whose work, in some respects, has changed my life. I know I've told Maxine that many years ago I read her book, and my life was changed as a result. So anyway, so thank you.
Next, we'll have Mary Ellen Robertson.
When I grow up, I want to be as gracious and magnificent a hostess and chef as Janet is. Okay. She brought me a tie. I haven't worn it yet. I've run into a lot of Mormon women, mostly on email lists, who are studying religion. And this is how this panel kind of came to be. I wanted us to get together and have a conversation about the kinds of things that we do, how we got interested in this field, where it's taking us, and just converse. So I'll begin doing that. I became interested in studying religion during an academic detour that took me to Ohio State University, and I was taking women's studies classes there as a prerequisite for their women's studies master's program. And I had to take a lot of intro classes because I hadn't taken women's studies classes at BYU, where I did my undergrad. They weren't offered until my senior year there, so I couldn't for a long time. And then when they were available, I had to take things that would help me graduate. And it was a hard thing to be torn between. So in these classes at Ohio State, it kept seeming to me that we were talking about the way principles in women's studies influenced politics, family life, sociology, psychology, all of these fields, everything but religion. And that's exactly where I gravitated with the papers that I wrote, saying it seemed such a glaring oversight to me to not talk about religion in women's lives and women's experiences with religion, because in a lot of ways this is one of the areas where a lot of the patriarchal, repressive stuff still lives and thrives, and I just couldn't see not talking about that. While I was in Ohio, I took the graduate record examination and checked a box saying, have schools send me information about their graduate programs. And I got information from Claremont Graduate School. They were trying to woo me into their English department. And in their materials, I also saw that they offered a women's studies in religion program. And I thought, hot dog, this is exactly what I want to do. You know, my two passions combined in one program, you know, the very things that I wanted to study at the same time in one program. It was so exciting for me. So I applied and was accepted and joyfully left behind Ohio's miserable weather and the miserable job that I had while I was there. And I started this wonderful Women's Studies in Religion program founded by a woman who wanted to see something like this develop at Fuller Seminary in Pasadena. And they patted her on the head, essentially, and said, okay, dear, hand over your money, and we'll put together the program for you. And so she essentially flipped them the bird, and I think she might have actually said a few choice things to them. But because of her association with another feminist faculty member at Fuller, who eventually fled there because it's an inhospitable environment for feminist scholars, they teamed up and built this program from scratch at Claremont, and they offer a master's and now a PhD in women's studies and religion. Ah, it's so exciting to be there. So I started taking classes on the divine feminine and how that manifested itself in world religions. I took an introductory class to women's studies and religion where we, you know, read kind of a lot of survey-type texts on how women were examining their own religious backgrounds and how they were re-envisioning some of the rituals and practices in communities that they had grown up in or that they were just interested in studying. And many of the papers that I did for school turned into Sunstone presentations. I did an ethnographic study of a singles ward at in Ohio. I looked at Lowell Bunyan's dissertation on the works of Max Weber, a sociologist of religion and a studier of charismatic leaders and the movements that they begat. We discussed ecstatic religious experience in early Mormonism, things like speaking in tongues at meetings, blessing and laying on of hands, Newell K. Whitney levitating to the top of a room, you know, when he was overcome by the Spirit. And that even made it into one of the Sunday school manuals a few years back. And so it's stuff that's still present in Mormonism but not talked about quite so much. I also wrote a paper on the Mormon concept of Mother in Heaven and presented it in class the same day that I found out that Janice Allred had been excommunicated for her writings on the subject. And so my work and what, you know, that part of my Mormon life was very much connected with what I was doing in school. And one thing that I was kind of proud of, making trouble in one area, I did a paper for a Christian ethics class that turned into an extended critique of what I called white Christian guy ethics. At the same time, I was reading women's writings on ethics for another class, and I knew I was reading really magnificent, spectacular things. And the white Christian guys really suffered by comparison in their sort of static, pie in the sky, we're going to talk about these things in lofty, abstract terms rather than concrete. How do we live ethically? How do we live as Christians ethically? And the paper ended up earning a rather unremarkable grade from the professor, but he ended up revamping the course content to include more writing, more women's writings on ethics, and I was very proud of that, even though he gave me a B. So, the insult. So, anyway, my area of specialty is women's studies and religion. I pay particular attention to women in Mormonism, gender and historical issues. A lot of my writings gravitate toward exploring and explicating my own religious tradition, my experiences with it. And I'm glad that there's so much that I could do and that my colleagues were really just hungry to hear what I was working on. I wrote a thesis for this program. The title is Subordination, hyphenated, Mormon Women's Historical Relationship with Spiritual Gifts and Priesthood Authority. And in it, I argued that in progressive periods in Mormon history, initially spiritual gifts were available to all members under clerical supervision at first, especially during the Kirtland period, and certain limits or prohibitions on the use of spiritual gifts evolved during that time. It was a very spiritually active time around the Kirtland Temple dedication and things like that. And in my work, I also explored how women were exercising some of the same spiritual gifts as male priesthood holders did, concurrent with their work in the Nauvoo Female Relief Society in the 1840s and beyond. And I argued that several factors contributed to the demise of women's use of spiritual gifts, and one was the gradual association and absorption of these gifts into priesthood functions. Initially, this is a spiritual gift, it's available to everyone, but now, no, giving blessings is really a priesthood thing. And so eventually that was eroded from women's use. And Brigham Young's decision to disband the Relief Society in 1844 didn't really help matters either. And up until that point, I argued that Relief Society and priesthood were developing concepts. In a lot of ways, they were developing on kind of a parallel trajectory that was cut short by the Relief Society dissolving and by people kind of assuming that these were priesthood functions when they initially had been more widely available. Also, Emma's relentless fight against polygamy and Joseph Smith's death were also things that factored into the demise of women's spiritual gifts at that point. Okay. I think the question of the contributions that this work makes to the field it's a little nebulous of a question. I think our mere presence in this field makes a contribution. That we make Mormon studies, feminist studies in Mormonism, visible through our presence and our work. And we make Mormon women's experiences more visible to ourselves first and to the larger field of religion and other Mormons. And I think our work makes important contributions on the human level. A lot of my colleagues were seminary students and had never been around a living, breathing Mormon for very long. And it soon became clear that I was not what they assumed to be typical. And they learned a lot from me, and I learned a lot from them. I think our presence in the field of religious studies also helps to paint a more accurate picture of Mormonism. I told a little bit of this story in a panel yesterday. When I went to my first professional conference, the American Academy of Religion's annual meeting in New Orleans, there was a paper on the program on a Mormon woman, and the presenter gave actually a different presentation than was abstracted in the conference program. And his paper asserted that Mormon women lagged behind their contemporaries in several ways. They were slow to leave agrarian lifestyles and the farm behind. They were not as educated as their counterparts and, like sheep, simply followed their men into Mormonism. And I knew, sitting there listening to this, this guy was just, this is just crap. And so I knew that, but I didn't have the stories, I didn't have the tools as a first-year graduate student to say, these are the facts at my command, and I know that's wrong, and this is why. Thankfully, Margaret Toscano was sitting in the session next to me, and got up and read the Riot Act to the guy during the question and answer period and pointed out, you know, Lucy Mack Smith's biography of her son, Emma Smith and others who led the Relief Society. They're, you know, Mormon women were anything but sheep-like in the early days. And the guy was sort of blindsided by this and stammered some sort of response, but essentially stood by his conclusions. And when I cornered him afterwards to ask what his research was based on and what sources he was using, he said, well, the research and stuff that I was looking at was based on pre-1830 literature. And I pointed out to him that pre-1830 sources also happened to predate the organization of the Mormon Church, and that there was no such thing pre-1830 as Mormon women to distinguish and look at in this way and insult in this way, practically. And he said that he just sort of fudged that part. And that was a big batch of fudge. And, you know, I'm still angry about that, and it's made me all the more committed to do accurate and honest historical work that's well substantiated and that can withstand the scrutiny of an academic environment. And let me tell the last little part of the story, and then I'll sit down. I think our, you know, like I said, our presence in the field also enlightens other Mormons, because there are a few BYU professors also in that session who were there for the Society of Biblical Literature part of this American Academy of Religions conference. And they came up to Margaret Toscano afterward and thanked her for her spirited defense of Mormon women. And afterwards, you know, we commented on the irony of this. These men, religion and church history professors at BYU, didn't know Mormon women's history well enough to set the record straight themselves. They were sitting there speechless, knowing that this guy was full of crap, and couldn't come up with any evidence, Johnny on the spot, to refute this misinformation. So BYU professors who were probably unlikely to give Margaret the time of day under any other circumstances are thanking her for standing up for Mormon women. So anyhow, it just... You know, there's a lot of work left for us to do, and like others have said, it's not without its risks. But you know, again, I feel that the risks that I've incurred have been worthwhile overall.
Next, we'll hear from Jana Reese.
The first question we've been asked to talk about is how we got into religious studies, and my question is, my answer is I have no idea. It was either, you know, divine providence or happy accident. I think maybe a combination of the two. I was 17 years old. I had no religious training whatsoever. My parents were enlightened free thinkers who were above such trivialities as religious faith. And so when I went to college, I went to Wellesley College, which is a women's college. I enrolled in a program called the Cluster Program, and it was a special kind of program where first-year students would look at one particular time and place in history in a very focused way, and all of our coursework would meld into that. And so I wound up taking this course on Judaism and Christianity in the Roman world, and I was completely hooked. I had no prior experience of this and had never even read the Bible, really. So this was, for me, very fascinating. And after that, well, that was, you know, many years ago, and here I am still in religion. And I'm just completely delighted and as fascinated with it now as I was when I was 17. So in college, my focus, my specialty was biblical studies, which kind of amazes me now because I can't read Greek anymore, and Hebrew is just as much a mystery. And so biblical studies was really what I lived and breathed when I was in college. And after college, I went to seminary with the idea of becoming a minister, and I was Presbyterian at the time. And so went through the ordination process in the Presbyterian Church, and at the same time was also reading this little book called The Book of Mormon, and it kind of ruined my life because I realized I couldn't become a Presbyterian minister after all. And so along the way, I changed focus from biblical studies to the history of religion in America, partly because I became very interested in Mormon history. And so in my last year of seminary, while I was very covertly attending the Princeton ward, unbeknownst to my Protestant colleagues at PTS, I was also doing my master's thesis, which was, this was in the fall of 1993, and my master's thesis was about the September 6th. And I actually was baptized in September of 1993, not coincidentally. To me, that had tremendous significance, and that's something that I was thinking about as I was going into the water. After seminary, since I had sort of wrecked this whole career plan of being a minister, I had to find something else to do. So I went to grad school, which is what most people do when they can't figure out what they want to do with their lives and don't have a job. And so I got my PhD in religion at Columbia. Columbia only because I wanted to stay in New Jersey. My husband decided that he really enjoyed his job, and so I only applied to schools that I could commute to. And as it turned out, Columbia turned out to be an absolutely wonderful place to study American religious history. It was fabulous. Columbia, the program there is most known, actually, for the study of Indo-Tibetan Buddhism. What's completely ironic to me is that in graduate school, when I was so focused on studying the history of religion in America and in the 19th century, I only took my one sort of required graduate course on Buddhism. And now, most of what I read is Buddhist studies. And I had all of that sort of at my fingertips back then, and I never took advantage of it. Such are the ironies. So, in graduate school, my focus was on women in 19th century sectarian movements, looking specifically at Christian Science, Shakerism, and Mormonism. And my dissertation was about Protestant women missionaries who came to Utah in the 19th century to try to save those poor Mormon women from polygamy, and about the schools that they wound up founding here because they couldn't get through to those recalcitrant Mormon women. And the dissertation was a heck of a lot of fun. I haven't done anything with it since I graduated. I defended it last spring, and I put it in a box, and until I have any desire whatsoever to think about Protestant women missionaries in Utah in the late 19th century, I'm not taking it out of the box. So, I got a job, and the fact that I got a job in religion to me is just one of these completely astounding proofs that God exists. I work for Publishers Weekly magazine. I'm the religion book review editor for PW. Publishers Weekly is it's the industry magazine of book selling and publishing. So, you know, any bookseller will consult PW basically on a weekly basis to find out what's coming up, what's good, what's awful. This is the section that I edit, the religion section, coming here, and this is a column that I write up through here. I receive about 60 religion books a week, and so a big part of my job is just sifting through, finding the wheat, and getting rid of all the chaff, which means a lot of recycling. Try not to destroy too many trees, you know. So in the course of my job, we cover everything from the Anabaptists to the Zoroastrians. And so I have been very excited to kind of beef up and round out my education by studying the things like Buddhism that I really neglected before. And one of the greatest parts of my job is that in my travels to book shows and to religion conferences and things of that nature, I get to meet leaders of all of these different religious traditions and really talk to them. And I've had some perfectly amazing conversations with people from all religious traditions. One Muslim woman was telling me how she's written a book about being Muslim in America, and she was telling me how difficult it is to really encounter people in this culture who have so many stereotypes about what Muslim women are and what they think. And I said, yeah, I hear that. Because in my subculture, you know, there are so many stereotypes of Mormon women by non-Mormons. And I'm encountering that constantly in my job. I'm the only staff at PW, and I think probably also in our parent company, we run a lot of different magazines. The magazine is owned by a parent company that has many others, and I don't think there's a single Mormon on staff anywhere that I've been able to find. So I'm also finding myself constantly in conversation with people at work or people that I encounter through publishing. And some of these conversations are really troubling, like when I was in Atlanta last month at the Christian Booksellers Convention. I met with this fellow. We were at an airport and kind of making small talk, trying to find things to talk about. And I said, oh, so what do you do? And he told me his name, and then I knew who he was because he's an author. A pretty successful author in the evangelical market. And he said, so I've written X, Y, and Z. And I said, yeah, I know, and I know who you are. And then he said, and then I also run this thing called the Christian Research Institute. And that sounded familiar, but I couldn't place why it sounded familiar. And so I asked him to explain, and then he said, oh, well, you know, we're trying to protect people from cults, and we publish literature about all the cults. And I just said, oh, you know, before you go any further, let me explain that I am a proud and card-carrying member of a cult, in your opinion. And so we wound up having this great discussion about Mormonism and evangelical Christianity, in which I bestowed upon him honorary status as a Mormon simply because he has 8 kids. And so I felt that we came to some sort of understanding. But in my job, I'm constantly having conversations like this. And I think if the motto of the church is every member a missionary, then I've decided that my mission is one of education. And that that extends not only to my roles within the church, although I think I'm also functioning as an educator there too, but within the wider culture, functioning as a liaison of sorts, a self-appointed crusader, maybe, to help people understand a little bit more about Mormonism. You would not believe the stereotypes that perfectly well-educated people have about Mormonism. I think that New York is probably the most provincial place in America, if not the world, and that is constantly brought to my attention. So in the course of my job, this is the last thing I want to say, I've become more of a generalist. I mean, I told you about college and seminary and grad school where I was specializing in these particular fields. But the glory of my job now is that I really get to stand back and try to assess the larger picture and assess the trends of religion in America, increasing religious diversity in America, and some of the demographic things that we're seeing happening. And so my work now is much more about the increasing religious diversity in America. And I just published this article, which I'm proud of. Wellesley called me up and wanted me to write an article about religion on campus and how it has changed. The Wellesley Religious Life Program has become a sort of beacon to colleges and universities all across America because they're reintegrating spirituality into education in a totally different model. It's not a model that says Protestantism is the norm, we have a Protestant chaplain, and all these other people are volunteers. You know, it's a model that says we have a Protestant chaplain, we have a Hindu chaplain, we have a Muslim chaplain, and whatever other student groups want a chaplain, we'll work with them. We'll get them a chaplain. So they called me and asked me to come to campus and write this piece called Beyond Tolerance, where I was interviewing alums and current students, professors, chaplains, and it was fascinating. I felt, you know, for me, since Wellesley was sort of the place where I found religion, this was a way of coming full circle. The other thing that I've been working on for the past year, and I'm thrilled to say I'm finally finished with, is this guidebook. After the dissertation, I wanted to write something very frivolous and frothy and fun. So I've been writing a guidebook to sacred sites of New England. It'll be published next fall. And it's a huge book. I thought that publishing a travel guide would be a lot more frivolous than it actually turned out to be. It was a heck of a lot of work. But it's fun because it's a multi-faith guidebook, and there are entries in the guidebook for Buddhist temples, for retreat centers of all traditions. There are 2 LDS entries, one for the Belmont Temple, which I have to say no one can go inside. I'm sort of violating my own rule in the guidebook because none of the other entries throughout the whole guidebook are things that people can't actually enter. But so I have this entry on the LDS temple in Belmont and then also on Joseph Smith's birthplace. But those are the only Mormon parts of the book. Everything else is all of the other things. So that's what I've been working on, and now I'm starting to write for the first time on Mormonism. And that's been very interesting. I'm writing a book on Mormon spiritual practice, not so much what we believe, but how what we believe is reflected by what we do. And so there are chapters in the book on how Mormons pray, how Mormons eat lime green jello salad. That is a chapter. And I'm out of time. Thanks.
Next, we'll hear from Maxine Hanks.
Well, I am just so impressed and so flattered and pleased to be with you on this panel. The caliber of women and the graduate degrees and the work these women have done. This is a fulfilling day for me to be able to be here and experience this. And I'll get to that in just a minute. But I'm just so grateful for all of you and the work that you're doing. And I cannot begin to tell you how much it means to me and how much it strengthens me. So thank you so much for being who you are and doing what you've done and including me in your panel today. What brought me to Mormon studies and religious studies? Let's see, I've been doing Mormon studies since 1975. I've been doing research and writing in Mormon studies since 1975. And religious studies I've been doing since 1996, the last 5 years. But what brought me, a couple of things brought me to do Mormon studies and religious studies. A tendency to be oriented toward mystical experience, which has been my tendency since childhood. And it was a very strong tendency that compelled me to want to explore that and understand it better. Having precognitive and visionary and intuitive and psychic gifts from the time I was a child kept me wondering what that was all about. And Mormonism, of course, provided a ready answer for all of that. The other thing was a strong will and a desire to learn and to make something of myself. I come from a fairly humble background, working class parents who are very humble and good people, and not an academic background. In fact, in my family, the mode of speech was non-standard English, very very informal, improper grammar, those kinds of things. And so the other thing that really propelled me in my life was this desire to want to have the same opportunities that other people had and to fight, to not be discouraged. And I would say that that has characterized my life. I've basically been a fighter and a warrior all my life because it seems like everything I have tried to do since I was a child, I have had people all around me telling me, you can't do it, you're not good enough, we don't want you, whatever, you know. And so those have been my motivating forces, driving forces. I suppose I'll just hit a couple of things in the last 25 years to a couple of highlights about what I've done in Mormon studies. I think I started with a column. I was writing a women's column for the Ricks College newspaper in 1975. I was the women's columnist. That was my first writing job. And we also hosted and planned the annual women's conference. We didn't call it feminism back then, but it was feminism. It was cultural feminism, classic cultural feminism. And all I knew was that I really wanted to promote women and talk about women's opportunities and invite powerful women to come and talk to us and write my little column every week. But I used to sneak to the library and read copies of Exponent 2, which was really neat because it had just started publishing and that really inspired me. After Rick's, I went on a mission. I had this desire to have a kind of a priestly calling or a godly calling, and this was the kind of mystical part of me that was always seeking for an outlet, wanting some kind of official opportunity like the men had in Mormonism to function as a partner with God in a kind of priestly or godly way. So that's why I went on a mission. I wanted that opportunity and came home from serving a full-time mission, taught at the Missionary Training Center for a couple of years, got involved in the Seventh East Press, where really I began to explore a lot of tougher issues in Mormon studies and take on some thorny and controversial topics. I also worked at Brigham Young University for 3 years as an editor, working with professors to help them publish manuscripts and find publishers for their manuscripts and help to launch the Humanities Publication Center there at BYU. And also worked at Sunstone briefly in 1986, writing some articles, things like that. So these are just some highlights. During all of this time, what I lacked was a language and I lacked terms, language, tools to be able to describe what it was that I was trying to do. I was very frustrated. I was being a feminist, trying to do feminist things in a very hostile, invalidating context. And even in liberal Mormonism, a lot of the people I encountered didn't have the same outlook that I had. And I found that there was no context for my experience. There was no language. And I so wanted to develop the ability to speak and act in a way that would help communicate to people what my experience as a woman was. So I dropped out of BYU and transferred to the U of U. And there enrolled in the Women's Studies program. And the Women's Studies program gave me those tools. It gave me feminist theory. It gave me the language that I needed and the theory that I needed to be able to communicate my experience and to be able to do some serious work in Mormon studies. And I think that for women in Mormon studies and religious studies, we need that academic training so that we can take our personal experience and our spiritual experience and our female experience and do something substantive, credible, that will advance the cause of women in Mormon culture. And so the training that all of these women have received is vital, and that I took at the University of Utah where I did my bachelor's in women's studies. Let's see, I'm going to skip on here. After having that training, I was able to begin to apply feminist theory to Mormonism. And one of the first things that I did was launch a column in the Mormon Women's Forum quarterly about theology, feminist theology. And I hadn't heard anybody use the term. I had been attending Sunstone for years, and I'd been hearing women do feminist work, but I hadn't heard anybody apply theoretical terms to Mormon studies, and I wanted to do that. So I started promoting the term feminist theology and launched a column called Theology, T-H-E-A, dash, and L-O-G-Y, talking about feminist theology. And I was also on a panel at Sunstone in 1990, I think it was, entitled The Current State of Mormon Theology. And the panel was mostly male. There were only a couple of women. Most of them were lawyers. And I was proposing the idea that we ought to be doing feminist theology in Mormon studies, and that that was really the cutting edge, and that was where the future was. And it was interesting because I was the last person to speak on the panel, and I was really scared, you know. I was really scared because for 10 years I had been trying to advance these ideas in Mormon studies, and I had really felt rejected and beaten down. And I'll get to that in a minute. But all of these people took their turn on the panel, and they all were doing traditional male Mormon theology, every single one of them. And I came in as the last person and said, we need to do feminist theology. I understand that it's speculative. I'm sorry, but really that's all we've got. The nature of feminist theology is so unformed and so unexplored that really speculative theology is all we can really do to start out. So forgive us for doing speculative theology and try to work with us. And it was interesting, Peter Appleby, rest his soul, who is no longer with us, stood up at the end of the panel and he said, it seems clear to me that we've already said everything we need to say about traditional male theology in Mormonism, and that Maxine is right, the future is feminist theology. And I felt so validated, and he was non-Mormon, and I felt so validated because I was so scared to stand up and give that presentation. I was shaking. I'll never forget that day. It was a huge crowd, and they were holding it outdoors, and I was just shaking. You know, I was so scared. Anyway, I continued to apply feminist theory to Mormonism by publishing my first book, Women and Authority, Reemerging Mormon Feminism. And that was my attempt to try to launch some serious women's studies approaches to the issue of Mormon women and priesthood and theology. So, and I won't spend a lot of time on that. I've talked about that a lot, but that's what I was trying to do. I was trying to apply feminist theory, women's studies, and I was trying to unite the generations and help women to see that feminism was generational in Mormonism, and that women keep reinventing the wheel, and that if we connect all those generations, we have a continuous history of feminism within Mormonism. I'm going to try to skip ahead here. Since 1996, after my excommunication in 1993, which I'll get to in a minute also, when I come to the risks of doing religious studies and Mormon studies. After the excommunication, I still wanted to pursue my dream, even though Mormonism had denied me the right of a priestly calling and an outlet for my mystical experience, any sort of formal outlet for my connection to God and to the divine. I decided, well, you know, life is too short. I'm going to go find somebody who will work with me. Lo and behold, in 1996, I stumbled onto Lance Owens, who has published in Dialogue. He published one of the finest articles I think ever written about Mormon studies, about Joseph Smith and Kabbalah. He is a practicing Gnostic priest, and he was willing to take me on and mentor me. And he, along with another former or inactive LDS priest, Troy Pierce, began working with me and mentoring me. And I began doing Gnostic studies and traditional Christian studies with them. And I chose to work with the Gnostics in an experiential route rather than going to grad school, although I have been talking to Claremont for a couple of years about their program. But so far, I'm wanting to stick with the experiential route of learning traditional Christianity and ritual and practicing ritual as an ordained person. And so I've been going through the steps of ordination in the Gnostic tradition, and I've been studying with two bishops, one in Los Angeles and one in Palo Alto, a female bishop and a male bishop who sort of head two different lines in the Gnostic church. That has been so healing and immensely, immensely rewarding for me to serve at Mass every Sunday, which I do, in my black Roman Catholic cassock, and learning the ritual, singing, speaking, moving into the harmony with the ritual, and experiencing priesthood experientially and personally has been probably the most empowering thing I've ever done for myself. Along the way, I've also been doing interfaith studies and working with a number of interfaith groups. The United Religions Initiative out of San Francisco, Grace Cathedral, and a couple of other interfaith groups, women's networks, and am affiliated with the establishment of the first interfaith chapel in Salt Lake up at Fort Douglas that should be dedicated this fall. So that's kind of what I've been doing, but I would say my three loves are mysticism, theory, and writing. And I may go to graduate school, I may not, I haven't decided. But I will keep writing, and I will keep on my path of ordination and experiential priesthood. I wanted to mention three risks. We're almost out of time. I'll try to wrap up real quick. I think that women need to be aware of three risks when you're doing religious studies and Mormon studies. The first is the generational gaps. Women of different generations have had very different experiences and very different contexts, and we need to work together and recognize that the older women have sacrificed a great deal and gained little ground, and they need to work with us in our healing and in moving women forward. And the younger women have got the skills and the tools, and they've got a better context, and we need to work together because we really need each other. Also, another risk to be aware of is new methodologies and frameworks. When you're advancing feminist theory, postmodern theory, post-structuralism, all of these new methodologies, deconstruction, quite often you're dealing with people who are coming from traditional academic methodologies and structuralist perspectives. I have run into this constantly, even in liberal Mormon studies. Cecilia Farr ran into this at BYU. This was one of the reasons why she got booted out. She was coming from postmodern perspective. The men who were judging her on her committee were coming from traditional structuralist approaches. They didn't understand each other. And so we have to learn how to talk to people who are coming from different methodologies and frameworks. Rejection, disapproval, and discipline. If you're going to be a woman doing Mormon studies or religious studies, you're going to be dealing with constant rejection, constant criticism, constant disapproval, and I want to say to all of you women, do not stop. Do not give up. No matter what people say to you, no matter how many times they tell you you don't know what you're doing, do not stop. Never give up. My motto is never give up. And do what your heart moves you to do, even if you think you might be excommunicated or your family may completely disapprove of you. I have been dealing with family disapproval and near disownment for almost 7 years now, and you have to follow your heart. So never give up. Thank you.
Before Cherie comes up, I wanted to thank everybody for coming and thank everybody that participated. It's really been a special day for all of us.
I just want to say a few words to wrap up. Because we have almost taken up all the time, and we want to leave time for questions and discussion afterwards. First of all, I wanted to point out there are many other women who could be on this panel as well. There's a rich resource of women who have done academic degrees or worked on their own in religious studies and have applied this to their Mormon heritage. Some that I know, Janice Allred has already been mentioned, Margaret Toscano has been mentioned, another outstanding woman scholar, Kathleen Flake, degree in theological studies, very good writings. And some that I know personally and know some of how their training and their academic interests interact with their Mormon lives. Nancy Bentley, who is a scholar of English literature at Penn, who did a project of research on pulp novels about Mormon women in the 19th century. For example, Laurel Ulrich, who is a professor at Harvard, who does women's history, American history, and has also studied Mormon history as a companion to that. Another example is a friend of mine, Marianne Cameron, who is a specialist in medieval Islamic texts from the University of Chicago, teaches world religions at Pace University in New York City, and was at the same time a gospel doctrine teacher in her Manhattan ward. So you see how these things combine in odd ways. One would expect that they would be delighted to have a professionally trained teacher and scholar teaching gospel doctrine, and for a while apparently they were, but she has recently been released and called to nursery. So perhaps, you know, there are many ways for a professional medieval Islamicist to serve in the church, and she may use her skills in nursery now. I'm going to speak briefly, wrapping up, to address two issues which relate to my own training, and that is being a professional historian and being a woman involved in church. My background is that I've just completed my dissertation at Yale, and I am now a lecturer on the history faculty. So my training is as a historian. I do not do Mormon studies, unlike the other women on this panel. I'm a specialist in Russian history and medieval history. Nevertheless, I find that my Mormon context comes into my own professional life in odd ways. It's where I got my training in the Bible, for example, which is absolutely crucial to medieval history. It's where I got my first exposure to the importance of studying and documenting and doing footnotes. The very first footnotes I ever read was when I was 14 years old and was reading Hugh Nibley for the first time. So you find that the introduction to academic thinking comes in an odd way through the church context. There are three points I wanted to make with regard to this theme about academia and church life. First of all, for me, academia is the least sexist environment I have ever worked in. Other people may have had different experiences, but when I make that point, I wanted to bring out, although we could always imagine that life could be better, if you have found a better, less sexist place to be, I would like to know it, because academia, at least they're worried about these things, and in my experience with the people I worked with, they had quite sincerely worked through sexist issues, and I never felt that being a woman was a barrier to any academic aspiration that I might have. As you can imagine, this is not true with church. I find that there are glass ceilings in many places with my church involvement, such that it is. About 10 years ago or more, I was involved somewhat in the Russian translation of the Doctrine and Covenants. And at the time I was working on it, checking the biblical background for the usage of some words in Russian. Shortly after we sent that project back to Salt Lake, having done what they had asked to do, apparently there was a an institutional decision made that only priesthood holders could work on scriptural translation projects like this. I hate to misrepresent this or misinterpret it, because I was never actually informed what the policy was, but it was clear that I was not going to be asked to work on it further. That was fine, because I was getting ready to go to Russia. I wasn't going to be available. But to the extent that that issue ever came up, that, within the context of academia, would be unthinkable. If you are trained in Russian, then you're trained. It's not an issue of holding the priesthood or not. Another example of that is in one of the discussion groups I was involved in through my work. We had had many very good discussions. We were a group of about 12 or 15 people. And at one point after we had spent all day in a retreat, in a workshop, dealing with issues, it occurred to me to ask afterwards, you know, it never struck me, are there more women in that group or men? Are we balanced? Because within that context, I never felt like women didn't get a voice. I felt like women were completely free to speak. I felt like men did not dominate the conversation, and I realized how different that feels than the church environment, where I always notice whether it's a man speaking or a woman speaking and how they present themselves, how they assume authority, whether they disagree, whether they agree, how free they feel to take the floor. And for those reasons, academia has become a very comfortable environment for me. The church is not a comfortable environment for me. My second point that I wanted to make about academia is, contrary to what many church members might believe, I have found there is no intellectual or academic hostility to Mormonism or to religion. I haven't been involved in religious studies to the extent that the other panelists have. But I can give you three examples of that. I'm preparing right now to teach a course on medieval saints that's going to start in September. The academic approach to medieval saints is highlighted by two different examples. I was at a conference. A woman was reporting on her research on a particular nun who was a candidate for sainthood and was reported every Thursday afternoon would give public audiences of being possessed by the spirit. Likewise, a recent study about saints' relics. The author of this study began by saying, I do not question whether miracles occurred or didn't occur. The important point is that people believed they occurred. And so the question of faith and miracles and these sort of supernatural things is not hostile to academia. But Mormons perceive it as being hostile, perhaps because it's just not a question. It's as if these are two separate dialogues. And the historians are very willing to believe that medieval saints believed in possession or they believed in miracles without dealing with the question of, well, were there actual miracles? This also applies when academics turn and deal with early church history. And I think Mormons find this confusing to deal with, how someone like Jan Shipps can report the First Vision and not weigh in on whether she actually believed it happened or not. This is a respect that I see coming from the point of academia, and it's a respectful way of dealing with religion which has its roots in anthropology going back even to the 1920s when people first made the point that people tell their own stories. It's one of the reasons that I like academia, because they allow this kind of agnosticism and respect. But I think that within the Mormon framework, this is very disconcerting. My final point is that I have found that running deep within my own studies and my own education is a principle which I can only identify as a Mormon principle, which arises out of my Mormon heritage, and that is that all education is a moral endeavor. All learning is a moral endeavor. This doesn't mean that all learning is morally good, but it means it has a moral weight to it, either for good or for bad. It means that it is part of the life choices that a person can make about eternal intelligence or about what one's essence is and what is the value of going through all of this effort in order to learn things when you could spend your life simply enjoying things. that I wanted to get back also and reiterate what Doe said at the very beginning, that being a part of academia has taught me that it's important what questions you ask, not what answers you hold to be true already, but which questions you're willing to go out and pursue. And I am a historian. I have found that history has been an absolutely rewarding field for me to go into, and I cannot help but realize that history is also essential bedrock for Mormon culture and Mormon understanding of ourselves. For that reason, I believe that in an odd way that my Mormon background has inspired and fueled my studies in history, even though they are not related to specifically to Mormon studies. I wanted to close with that and reiterate the ethical foundation of education and of asking questions and of the primary importance of pursuing truth, which is, I think, what lies behind my studies, my choice of profession, and I hope my profession in the future as I become a university teacher and an author and a writer. Thank you.
If anybody has any questions, if you'll, do you suppose we should have people come up here? You can either use this mic or you can use this one, and then we'll share the mics to
answer
your questions.
Does this work?
I'll present this to the entire panel. As a recent graduate from a master's degree, I'm finding myself in the position of trying to publish some papers that address the use of documents and the collecting of documents in the American West, and specifically within Utah, and some of the cultures and cultural attitudes towards diaries and records and other personal belongings, but being published in a academic, non-LDS-oriented environment. And I just wondered, as each of you, and Janet, you alluded a little bit to this, have to address these topics and themes, but present them to an outside audience, what some of the issues, you know, have you overcome, how much to explain, how much not to explain, and how to present this.
I specifically wrote my thesis to be accessible to a non-LDS audience, because I felt like, you know, there had been work done in Mormonism, published in Sunstone and Dialogue and other places, on Mormon women's spiritual gifts, and I wanted to put that in the larger context of what I had been studying, which was expressions of ecstatic religious experience in, you know, from the 1740s to 1840s in America. And so it was really important for me, and I had to explain a few things about why I felt it was important to do that, and I had to talk about the language, why I'm calling it the Mormon Church as opposed to whatever the new long-tailed use on every reference name is now. And there, yeah, I had a struggle on how much was too much explaining, how much could an interested yet not necessarily educated on this topic audience assume about Mormonism. And it was helpful to have, you know, non-LDS advisors review this, and to have Janet read basically every syllable I wrote to say, am I saying enough here about this? And I think it was that balance between having someone who is inside read it and assess that, and having several outside sources, you know, who were educated, interested in the topic, read it and say, you know, have I said enough here about this? So it was a balancing act, definitely.
I won't use my soprano voice.
It's your aura.
I thought it was my tie. No. Didn't I say that earlier? you know, it's a really good question, because it's one that I am constantly addressing in my writing as a scholar of Mormonism, and that is, how much information do you give? I mean, you don't want to talk down to people. One of the things that you have to be very aware of, or that I've had to be very aware of in my writing, is that I'm not patronizing. Because I'm writing not just for the benefit of Mormons. You know, like my thesis was meant not just to benefit non-Mormons, but to benefit Mormons too. I wanted it to be something that would begin to open up the doors for Mormons to begin talking about their temple experiences. But at the same time, I also wanted it to be something that non-Mormons could come to and gain a greater understanding about what it is that drives and motivates Mormons overall. My belief being that the temple is one of the greatest defining elements in our theology, and it basically underlies how we define ourselves and how we behave and act in the world. It provides us with an ethic, because it's the pinnacle experience in our church, and we have to live our lives to the point of getting to that place. So writing in a way that wouldn't be patronizing to Mormons or boring for them, but at the same time that wouldn't be patronizing for people on the outside, and finding that balance was certainly not an easy task. The other question, too, is how much do you say? I mean, you know, you say too much and then it's boring, or not enough and then it remains vague and esoteric. And so, again, how do you build that bridge of understanding? It's an enormous challenge, and I don't really know how to tell you how to bridge that gap, except to do what Mary Ellen has suggested, and that is have non-members read it and also have members read it. I know for me it was really good to have my advisor read it, who was RLDS and who knew quite a bit about the temple, but... And have him come back and say, you know, I really think you need to address this thing. You can't leave this out. You have to talk about this. And to have someone like Mary Ellen read my work and say, you know, I think there's too much detail here. I don't think you need to be quite this explicit or quite as detailed in this sense, because it's sort of implied that this will be understood. So I think having, as she said, having people who can look at your work. The other thing, too, is what is your point? I mean, what's the point of what you're doing? You know, try to define your audience as quickly as possible. Who do you want your audience to be? That'll help.
Footnotes.
Oh, I've got
a giant one.
It's me.
I think anybody else?
You don't have to read this. I don't want to.
Just one quick thing I'll add. I mean, they've explained it really well. It depends on your audience, of course, and it depends on what materials you're making available, but be rhetorically sensitive. You know, understand, like Janet said, your audience and what their perspective is, and then find a parallel example within their culture that you can compare to and use as an illustration. It helps a lot. Any?
Would you carry the microphone out? Any more questions?
Yeah, I just had one. We're probably past the time for that thing anyway. Janet, when you went to the RLDS church to speak, I wonder if you just give your kind of feeling about the women and priesthood issue there, and what do you, you know, like as a model? Well, I think
the interesting thing about the RLDS congregation is that, I mean, it seems kind of unoriginal that I would be there. You know, these are our cousins. Ooh, whoopee. Although I did have a lot of people when I was at the Graduate Theological Union who would ask me, well, are you here seeking holy orders? Because the majority of the people there are studying to be priests. And I said, are you crazy? You couldn't pay me enough to have the priesthood. But my experience in the RLDS church is that I've watched some really dynamic, very capable women lead a very struggling congregation and do a damn fine job. And not just because they have priesthood, but just because they're good people and they're passionate and they have a sense of spirituality and a sense of direction, and they want their church to grow and they want it to be a spiritual refuge for others. Do I think women should have priesthood? No. And I say that, I don't say that lightly. When I say no, what I mean is I don't want priesthood, women to have priesthood as it is currently constituted, because I think that it's too ambiguous. I don't think that we've clearly defined priesthood. I think priesthood has too many definitions. We use it as a noun. We use it as a verb. We use it as an adjective. And we're never quite clear on what it is. It's just the priesthood. And it becomes this amorphous, all-encompassing, hierarchical, oppressive thing.
So until we can define priesthood in a way that that kind of gets away from that that hierarchy and that ambiguity, I'm really not interested in having it. Now, that goes contrary to many of my feminist sisters who say, priesthood now, and I applaud that, and I'm more than happy to support them in that fight and in that endeavor, but if they came out tomorrow and said, we're now going to give women priesthood, I'd be the last person in line. But it is gratifying to see other women in other settings participate on an equal level, and I think that's because their definitions are a little clearer than ours. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it was a pretty vague question.
Okay.
Time is up, but any